Inside the Cross Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast. I am Terry Foy, coming at you on a day when pretty much everybody else is talking about the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship game, Louisville versus Michigan. Certainly an exciting one. I'm a little disinterested at this point because I already won one of my brackets and finished second in the other one. So, you know, I'm kind of checked out. Really, you know, if the Cardinals win, so be it. Just a little bit more icing on the cake. But, no, we're here to talk lacrosse, and we got a good show planned. Appreciate you checking out the podcast. We, as always, are bringing you a look back at the weekend that was. We're going to be talking to Casey Vach, who was on hand at Albany's win over Johns Hopkins. And like I hope you and I did, we watched Syracuse beat Princeton. Also going to talk to Brian Foley again, our Boston area correspondent, who had another doubleheader of him, or a doubleheader of his own, taking in Cornell's comeback win over Harvard on Saturday, and then Notre Dame's late pulling away win over Providence on Sunday. But I was able to not only catch a few of those games that we just mentioned, but also check out a few more games on TV and online. So I wanted to share a few thoughts as you dive in to this podcast. So on Friday night, you know, really good times changing back and forth between Hopkins Albany as well as Navy Maryland. Certainly that's a rivalry game. You know, I'm sure that for John Tillman, who spent a long time kind of, I think, formed himself as a coach on the sidelines and assistant at Navy, and certainly has deep ties to that program still. You know, it's always going to be a game that means a lot. I talked to Coach Tillman last week for a magazine story that I'm writing, and it was, you know, just kind of, you get, I don't know what the vocal expression is that's similar to a glint in his eye, but that's the way he gets talking about Navy. So, you know, isn't a huge surprise that the Mids come out with one of their best games of the season to date as they play in Maryland really tough. You know, I think it also isn't a huge surprise, and get a little bit more into this talking about both Cornell and Notre Dame later in the podcast. Isn't a huge surprise that at this point in the season for a top-ranked team, you know, a team that hasn't lost a lot, you know, sometimes the motivation is a little bit difficult to muster, whereas on the other side of the coin, you know, a team like Duke, who, you know, suffered some early season losses, you can see the rubber kind of meeting the road for them, and their wheels are spinning faster as they get into this midseason stretch. For teams like Maryland, Cornell, and Notre Dame, where their resumes are pretty well established, and if you haven't seen yet, which if you're listening to this on Monday, it's because it's not posted yet, check out InsideLacrosse.com on Tuesday, as I will be posting my first bracketology of the season. Some interesting surprises, but for the most part, I think that the resumes shape up similar to the way in which the pollsters have been voting over the last couple weeks. But getting back to it, I just think that at this point in the season, it's difficult to maintain a consistent emotional presence on game day. And I think a lot of times you see these really talented teams kind of save their efforts for late in game situations when they realize that, you know, winning time is around the corner, and that's why Cornell can reel off a 7-2 fourth quarter over a good Harvard team. You know, Notre Dame can kind of put together, I believe it was an 8-4 second half to separate themselves from Providence, who would manage to hang around for a good portion of the first three quarters. And that's just the way it is. And I think that with Maryland, you saw that as well. You know, don't want to take anything away from the quality performances that the opponents put in. But, you know, certainly that was kind of that there. We're going to talk a little bit more about Hopkins Albany. So I'm going to move on to Saturday. And I think that, you know, good day for lacrosse. They had staggered game times. I was able to watch, Colgate Lehigh at 11 a.m. on CBS Sports. And then at noon on the Big Ten Network, Hobart versus Ohio State. And then 2:30 free web stream, Loyola versus Fairfield. So a few observations from each game. You know, I thought that you know, particularly in the first half, which was pretty narrow or you know, close throughout the first half. Run of play kind of favored Lehigh. I felt a little bit you know, kind of hard for me to take away too much from this game. Ryan Walsh was obviously very good and very impressive early. You know, I thought that his strength, his ability to get to It's not even 5-5. It's more like 1-5. He's able to kind of drive directly up from GLE and get an inside roll because of his ability to not get pushed off his spot. Was one of the things that was most attributable to Colgate being able to hang around. But then, you know, Lehigh was able to separate themselves in the second half, and I think that, you know, in some ways it's a product of their depth offensively. I think you know, in some ways it's a product of just a little bit of an edge, I think, at the faceoff X and being able to control possession. But gotta say, I wasn't able to watch the second half as closely. Did DVR it, going to be able to go back and check it out at one point this week, because I did switch over to Hobart, Ohio State, and for whatever reason, that was a game that intrigued me a little bit more. I've been interested in the way that this ECAC race is going to unfold, you know, particularly as Bellarmine has kind of injected themselves into the conversation, and in my opinion at this point is in the driver's seat for the fourth spot in the conference tournament. You know, I think that it was a Hobart team that, you know, is good. They have talent. They obviously have a lot of offensive talent. You know, Alex Love, Cam Stone, and then Bud Graham and Matt Otsall, two freshmen who I think are, you know, kind of looking to turn into Cam Stone and Alex Love over the course of their career. You know, those are four guys that I think that, you know, are difficult for teams to prepare for. But I was so impressed by Ohio State. You know, I think that they are themselves a very difficult team to prepare for because of the depth offensively that they've been able to develop alongside Logan Schuss. And I think that, you know, when you look at Logan as a player, he strikes me as the type of guy who's going to be able to play midfield at the next level because he's able to dodge so well from the top of the box. And I thought that he did a good job of that in this game. You know, he's obviously lefty, so he's going to be relatively one-handed. And I think it's a little bit more difficult for some guys to do that when they dodge from the top of the box than it is when they dodge from either X or the wing, because they know what spot they want to get to. Whereas a lot of times when you're dodging from up top, the spot that you want to get to is dictated in some ways by the spot that the defense is giving you. It was interesting to see him kind of navigate that. He's very good with S dodges. Is very good at coming back, you know, to his hand when he gets close to the goal, coming across his body, you know, all that good stuff. And then, you know, in terms of Ohio State's defense, which impressed me as well, you know, they're very good off the ground. They're very athletic when the ball's on the ground in their own zone. They're not necessarily the type of team that pushes tempo and transition the way that that athleticism might dictate they could be able to, but I don't think it's to their detriment because, as we just kind of discussed, they're very efficient offensively. You know, I thought that it was interesting to see a goalie change out of that team, and if they talked about it on the broadcast as to why, whether it was an injury, illness, or coach's decision, I missed it. It had been my impression that Greg Dutton, while he's never going to be a goalie that pushes towards 60%, had played well, and he is the type of goalie that brings you things in the other aspects of the goalie game that are valuable. I thought that, Sean Spencer played really well, and it was the type of guy that was good in that position down the stretch. I thought that, you know, for a guy who doesn't have a lot of experience, he did a nice job, you know, coordinating his defense. There were a couple times that I noticed, restarts off the end line, different types of switches that got good matchups that were inverted. He did a really good job of communicating with his defense what he wanted to see, particularly as the ball was waiting at X and getting ready to go. I thought that was an interesting thing to note, particularly as this is an Ohio State team that, you know, has been, they're going to be the third seed in the ACAC tournament, in all likelihood, and it's not an uncommon spot for them. It's basically been either the third or fourth spot for the last few years, but I think that this is a better Ohio State team than those teams, and I think that, you know, they're potentially going to have a good at-large resume. Kind of depends on what happens down the stretch with some of their RPI wins, and certainly, you know, the most substantial one would be that if Virginia is able to get a couple of wins and become a top 20 win, that will help them a lot. But either way, you know, it's an Ohio State team that I think has May aspirations, and it'll be really wild to, you know, see what they can do if they have the opportunity to capitalize on those. And then lastly, you know, Loyola Fairfield, another ECAC matchup that I had my eye on. You know, the Greyhounds were able to jump out to a pretty significant lead. Fairfield battled back, I think, in the second quarter, probably cut it to maybe like an 8-4 lead, but it always felt a little bit longer than that. I think that there was a few goals that Loyola was able to get easy, both in transition as well as in, kind of their settled offense with Mike Sawyer just kind of, you know, popping open on the crease and being able to finish pretty quickly, that were just very reminiscent of the Loyola that we saw last year. And, you know, for Fairfield, a team that is good but has struggled at times this year, you know, they didn't have the answer for that, and I wasn't overly surprised by the way in which that unfolded. As a result, you know, Loyola was able to get a good win, you know, just kind of move on, and now the ACAC showdown that everybody's been waiting for, their game against Denver in Baltimore is squarely in, you know, every ECAC fan site as the Pioneers come to town next Saturday. That being said, wasn't able to see this game, just able to watch it kind of via Twitter, but I can imagine how it unfolded, and certainly Denver's ability to beat Bellarmine in double overtime with Dylan Ward making 20 saves. Would have really liked to have been there. Don't have a whole lot that I can say about this game, but maybe someday I'll be able to get my hands on a tape and I'll be able to tell you guys a little bit more about it. But with that said, I'm going to go ahead and bring in Casey Vach, and he is going to give us a little bit more on this Albany-Hopkins game. And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast continues with Casey Vach, one of my esteemed coworkers here at Inside Lacrosse, who was on hand to watch the Albany Great Danes beat the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. And then, like hopefully most lacrosse fans out there was able to watch the Syracuse Orange take in that doesn't make sense. Was able to watch the Syracuse Orange beat Princeton on ESPNU on Saturday. And Casey, I want to talk to you because not only were you able to see, you know, a pretty significant win for the Great Danes program, but also being an upstate guy who's well familiar with the Thompsons, went to Syracuse, you can speak really well about both of these results, both of these games, and how they fit into the scope of the season. I wanted to start with talking about just, you know, for Albany to beat a team like Johns Hopkins at this point in the season, advanced to 7-3 on a national TV stage, you know, despite the fact that Lyle Thompson didn't have the results from the production standpoint that he had had coming into the season, still a significant win for the program, for this team, etc. What do you think is the most important thing that you're going to take away from this weekend, Albany's ability to beat Johns Hopkins at Homewood Field?
Well, for me, it's going to come down to the play of their goalie, Blaze Reardon, who I watched for a long time through his high school career, and then their play on the defensive end. Some people can point to, well, Stanwyck's production. I think he had 4 goals and 2 assists. It certainly had the feel of putting the team on his back at times when they really needed some points. But the thing is that the defense for Albany played just good enough to put the Johns Hopkins shooters in position where Blaze was able to make a lot of easy saves. Well, I've already heard some people questioning the shooting of the Blue Jays, and I think that there's something to that. You can definitely see that of the 20 saves that he made, you know, not all of those were necessarily ones that he really had to fight to challenge for. And in watching Blaze through his career, I do think that he's a better shot stopper on low shots than on high shots. And I think that didn't necessarily pan out the way that the scouting report likely had indicated, and some of the comments from the coaching staff and even from the players themselves, I think were indicative of the fact that they could have made better decisions in their shooting. Also, Wells Stanwyck's comments after the game about sort of blaming themselves for the inability to get it done on the offensive end, I can see where he's coming from on that, because I thought that the Hopkins shooters were not in the position that they wanted to be in, and there was even a play near the end of the game where Wells drove from X across the left side, got above GLE, turned to look down, and I don't think Palmer was in the place that he thought he was going to be in. And that, to me, sort of like summed up the experience. Is Albany's defense outstanding? No, it is not, but it stepped up and rose to the occasion on Friday night, and I think that was amazing. You can't really just talk about Blaze making 20 saves. You have to talk about the defense doing enough to make things tough at times for the Johns Hopkins players. And yes, you could probably make some criticism of the Johns Hopkins midfield, which, yeah, I'm still kind of scratching my head about a little bit at this point in the season with the performance that it's had. But the fact of the matter remains, Albany stepped up big. They pushed the shooters out on the wings, specifically Brandon Benn and Zach Palmer. I wondered how many times, you know, Palmer was going to get shots from GLE where he was just above and maybe could have taken a few steps higher. But he didn't, and I think part of that is that the defense for Albany was playing with a lot more confidence than I've ever seen out of this team so far. I was right there with everybody who was sort of doubting them in terms of what they could do on the defensive end of the field, and so I think that's the biggest thing to take away from this, is that they weren't just playing any old team. I still have a lot of faith in this Hopkins team and their ability to make it into the playoffs and make a run. I think there's a lot to be said about what they're capable of doing. It just hasn't happened yet. And so, to be fair, I think you've really got to applaud Scott Maher and the plan that he had coming in, because they really just didn't give them anything easy. Yes, some of the shots were probably poor placement, but again, I mean, this is really the best I've seen that unit play. They played with a lot of intensity, they seemed athletic, and they seemed to never let down, which was a big takeaway for me.
And staying on this game real quick, you mentioned an interesting comment about Albany's face-off preparation. I don't know if you can share that, but it was significant because, you know, for a Johns Hopkins team that had enjoyed such an advantage at that spot on the field with Mike Poppleton, Albany's ability to win a few, to stay competitive, and it sometimes at some stretches over the course of the game really exceed that, was also a significant factor in the outcome.
Big time. I was talking to Jai Thompson. He's the father of the Thompsons, the father of Jeremy, Jerome Jr., Lyle, and Miles. And I actually heard him say that Kevin Gleichert had come to him and asked him for a little bit of advice. Jai has worked very closely with his sons in facing off. Jeremy obviously is a face-off guy. Lyle spent a lot of his days facing off, and all of them actually are able to face off. It's kind of something you see in a lot of box players and a lot of guys off the res. They just have that ability. He offered up to take a look at like what Mike Poppleton does, another kid that he's probably a little bit familiar with from watching his kids play in Central New York. And he just simply, I don't know if he got on the phone or if they actually spoke in person, but I was told that he offered up advice to Kevin, and it seems like Kevin has been a bit of a work in progress throughout the season. And Mike Poppleton is probably one of the better faceoff guys in the country. In a one-goal game, I have to look at that and see that he won something like 9. Let me double-check real quick here. He was only 9 of 23. But, I mean, if you think about that in the context of a one-goal game and how powerful Hopkins can be just based on the possessions they can get, I think that's pretty significant and a big thing to take away, because if this team moves forward the way that I think a lot of people think that they can, with maybe only Stony Brook standing in its way, that's going to be a big deal if this Gleicher kid can continue to sort of gain momentum and feel more confident about himself. He was given the game ball after the win. I thought that was pretty cool. In a game where Lyle gets basically blanked on the scoreboard and they get dominated, not dominated, but the majority of faceoffs do go Hopkins' way, I think you've got to applaud a kid who's able to win 9 of 23 against a Mike Poppleton-type player. That did turn out to be a big deal in this game.
And then just kind of looking at the way that this season has developed for Albany, obviously turned some heads with an upset in the Dome. I believe it was the program's first win in the Dome to open the season. They're now 8-3 after beating Hartford on Sunday. So, you know, another impressive aspect of that Hopkins win is that they then turned around 2 days later and put a hurting on a Hawks team that went to the NCAA tournament 2 years ago. So, you know, they've got 3 America East games left and a midweek rivalry game against Siena, Capital Region Showdown. They probably are the heaviest favorite in their conference tournament of any team in its conference tournament throughout the rest of the season. When you look at the at-large resume of the Great Danes, they've got, you know, a couple top 20 wins, obviously Syracuse. One that's a little bit tenuous right now is their win over UMass as to whether or not they'll fall in or out. It's interesting to me that the win over Johns Hopkins, I would imagine, strikes the team as being so much more significant than a win over, say, Drexel or Bucknell. However, with Hopkins falling outside of the top 20 RPI, for the moment at least, you know, that's not as valuable as a win over those two programs to whom they lost would have been. Sum it up. What was the sense in talking with Coach Marr and some of the other folks on the team after the Hopkins win in terms of where this positioned them going forward?
Well, that's a great way to sort of pose what this means to the program. And I think that you really got to – I think you can remove the discussion about the NCAA tournament from what this means to Scott Marr and his players. In terms of an emotional win, this is on par with the Syracuse win. You know, there was a lot of discussion after the game of who was the last team to be able to beat Syracuse and Hopkins at their respective venues on the road in a single season, and there was talk about it possibly being Virginia in the mid-90s, something like 1996. I don't think that this team is banking on the Hopkins win being what gets them into the playoffs or even the Syracuse win. I think that they're perfectly confident in their ability to win the America East. But what the Hopkins win does is does more for this team just now and moving forward than maybe all of these conference games can. I mean, that might sound sort of obvious or redundant. I mean, it's going to carry forward into the overall future of this program. I mean, it just gives them a ton of confidence that they can win games that seemingly the chips are stacked against you. Because, like I said, if you would have told me Lyle gets blanked in this game and you would have told me that they only win 9 of 23 faceoffs, which turned out to be more, I guess those 9 were bigger wins than I can even sort of quantify because transition was important in this game. But if you were to tell me those stats, I would tell you Albany probably loses by 5 or 6 goals. That's not what happened. And so to me, you know, what this game means, I think, can be separated from what it might mean for their resume getting toward the end of the season. That might sound like a cop-out, but it's not, because that wasn't the discussion, you know, after the game. And certainly that's in the back of everybody's minds. But personally, I still think that there's plenty of opportunity for Hopkins to turn it around and become a quality win, whether it's a top 20 RPI win or top 10, I don't know. A lot still has to be determined. But when I look at that, that's what I think we can potentially devalue the talk of what this win means for Albany, both in a, I guess, spiritual sense and a realistic sense for the future of this team this season. I think talking about Hopkins being down sort of devalues that, because I don't buy that. I still think this is a very good Hopkins team. So that being the case, you know, I'm not so sure that the team is even viewing it that way. In the back of their minds, certainly, you know, they realize that this is the potential to get them in, it could help them get into the tournament if things got tough or things got hairy in the America East. But as we saw, you know, they blow Binghamton off the field a team that just beat Stony Brook in overtime. So, I mean, I think that this team is going to win the America East, and I think they think they're going to win the America East because they are certainly playing at a high enough level to do so.
Well, and it's a team that is used to realizing that that's their road into the playoffs. It's interesting, too. I think that there are some parallels between this and the 2007 team. And when you look at the 2007 team and how much their win on home one field validated their efforts, you know, after they had had a pretty good season the year before, but ultimately helped them elevate to number two in the polls, you know, that was a substantial aspect of what that team was. And, you know, ultimately, you know, it was a team that was a Final Four caliber team. So really interesting, and I agree with you on a lot of those points moving forward. I think that, you know, the one thing that is going to be kind of interesting to watch it evolve is how, you know, the fact is that for a lot of the country, this was a lone opportunity to see Albany on TV between now and the end of the season. And you've gotten a chance to see them play online a lot more frequently. I'm sure that you would recommend other folks try to take advantage of that opportunity as well. You know, I want to say that for Lyle Thompson's player of the year type hopes, the fact that he was blanked isn't going to have a huge impact because of the fact that they got to see how dangerous he is. You know, it was clear that in some respects, you know, his lack of statistical production was a byproduct of, you know, either some bad luck or some good defense or a combination of all of that. So, you know, that'll be another aspect of how this will kind of unfold as a storyline going forward. But let's quickly move on to CUSE and Princeton. You know, another game that was pivotal in terms of not just the fact that it was a one-goal game, really exciting on television. A lot of fans got an opportunity to see it. But, you know, just two good teams going toe-to-toe. What did you learn about Syracuse and Princeton that you're going to – that's going to be, like, front of mind as you think about these teams, their playoff hopes, their title-contending hopes over the course of the next month?
Well, my takeaways for Syracuse come down to their depth. I think it's interesting that you can look at this game, look at the stat line, and see that off the bench, Princeton gets something like one goal, 1 point total. I believe in looking at the stats, it's something like 10 off the bench for Syracuse. Let me just double-check that real fast. And sorry. Yeah, 11 points. No, 10 points. 10 points off the bench for Syracuse, including 4-2 coming from the Oregon man, Henry Shoemaker. I'm blown away by this team's sort of like exceeding of expectations for a lot of the people in upstate New York this year. It's been interesting to hear the change in the tone of voice for a lot of Syracuse fans, people talking about doing 180s with this team and that kind of thing. The depth on this team is pretty impressive. I mean, the fact that they're able to play with four different attackmen, all of whom can be productive at any given point, I think says something about the changes that they made on the offensive end of the field to adjust to having a smaller group of attackmen in the face of injury to Nicky Galasso, in the face of injury to Mike Daniello. And then if you look at the midfield, this is where I think the team gets really, really scary and dangerous if you're not familiar with them from top to bottom. A kid like Henry comes off of the second line and puts up 4 goals and 2 assists and almost doesn't even break a sweat in doing it. And that allows them near the end of the game, because he's playing so well, to bump him up, you know, forcing Princeton to say, are we going to cover JoJo Marasco or are we going to cover Henry? And at that point, that's when JoJo, down, I think, 2 goals, you know, JoJo had something to do with the last 3 goals, 2 assists, and scores the game winner on a pretty amazing effort. I think to go back to this, this is what impresses me about Syracuse, is that they've got just a list of guys who can get it done. Whether they're athletes, more athletic than actually lacrosse players, which was a big theme of the weekend, talking about lacrosse players. But they've also got that. They've got lacrosse players, kids like Kevin Rice and Dylan Donahue. Those are lacrosse players. And then you combine the fact that some of those lacrosse players are actually pretty athletic, like a JoJo Marasco and a Luke Cometti. And I think that's what I take away from this team, is that they just have a lot of weapons that are seemingly interchangeable. At attack, you've seen that, you know, you can swap out Ward, Donahue, Rice, Maltz, and have a couple different looks that I think confuse teams. And near the end of the game, that's what – I don't know if it's necessarily a product of Kevin Donahue's new way of running the offense, which is so Wes Jenny-like that it's almost a thing of beauty. But to me, there's – what's interesting is how easy this team can generate looks and how it's guys coming off the bench that are involved in all of that.
Well, it's interesting to me because I think that a lot of your points are well taken. What was, I think, very difficult for a lot of Syracuse fans to swallow is the fact that, you know, a lot of their offensive weapons are guys that are relatively, I don't want to say one-dimensional in a pejorative way, I want to say one-dimensional in a way that they aren't necessarily expected to do a lot more than what their one skill set kind of dictates that they're going to be asked to do. But I think it's a difficult... not only is it a difficult way to coach because you need to become very familiar with your personnel, but it's also a way of coaching that this Syracuse staff, I think, is still getting used to after having spent a generation coaching transcendent talents. And it's not to say, it's not to knock Coach Desko and his staff. It's to say that I think they're still getting used to it. And as a result, I think that they're a team that will probably continue to get better in a substantial way over the course of not just this season, but every season, you know, and then it's going to be interesting when they do get those transcendent talents. And I think that there are some guys, you know, on the way that people expect to kind of fit that mold, but it does create an interesting juggling act, and I think that's kind of what you're seeing and why, you know, they can put up, among all the other factors, and, you know, among those factors of the fact that this isn't necessarily Princeton's strongest defense of the last 10 years, but able to put up 13 goals on Princeton. And I wanted to make one point building off of what you said about Princeton and the difference between the depth of the two teams, their scoring punch and their bench. You know, I thought that there was... The thing that impresses me the most about Princeton is that they've got at least four. It kind of depends on how you define known quantities. But I think at this point it's safe to assume that both Jake and Jeff Ricaro, Mike McDonald's and Tom Schreiber are known quantities. And I'm ready to put Ryan Ambler into that mix as well, even though he hasn't necessarily had as many consistent standout performances. But he's kind of rounding into form that way. When you look at a team that's kind of constructed offensively around guys like that, it seems uncommon that you get consistent production from all four of them in more games than not, meaning that typically it seems like defenses try to take away one or two of the guys and you rely on your other two or three guys that aren't being prioritized to make plays. I've been impressed in the opportunities that I've gotten to see Princeton play out of all of the guys' ability to make a contribution in the score sheet primarily, but really, you know, just kind of generally in the overall scheme and flow of the game. And I think that that's one of the things that makes this Princeton team special. You know, they aren't incredibly deep insofar as they're not necessarily going to get a lot of points from their fourth or fifth attackman or their second or third midfield lines, but they're able to get so much production from their top flight players that I think that they're able to utilize those role players in ways that are a little bit more suited for the idea of a role player.
No, I can agree with all that. And you kind of you hit on some things I was going to talk about. I mean,
didn't want to jump all over you.
No. It was well put together. You put it together better than I probably could ever hope to. But no, I mean that's a good point. I mean, you look, McDonald had 3 points. Ficarro has 4 points. Schreiber has 4 points, and a good portion of the defensive scheme for Syracuse was an effort to limit him. And reading some articles from Syracuse-based media, it sounds like he did get pretty frustrated after the game. But I think that's indicative of this Princeton team and the character they have. Very tough, tough kids with, like, winning mentalities that come out of the metro area that I've, you know, followed through high school. Extremely talented players. I think it's interesting that Princeton, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but, you know, for all those years was this defensive powerhouse under Tierney, and certainly had some very good offenses in the late 90s. But this offense is very, very scary to me. I feel like this team could make some real major noise if it got, you know, were to get into the playoffs and make a run. And I think right now they're one of only two teams in the top 10 that have scored more than 10 goals in every single game. So, I mean, just a consistent offense across the board, you know, for the lack of depth that they might have, sure. But, I mean, the key players are showing up every game and showing up in big games, and this game could have gone the other way for them. So kudos to the Orange to kind of rally there near the end. It was a great game to see, and got to give a little shout-out to Nike, STX, and Cascade for putting together a pretty cool kit for Syracuse, because we've seen a lot of one-offs this year, and it's not always gone well for this team, so,
yes.
And it went pretty well for them, I guess, so.
And, so it was a good weekend upstate, but certainly, we got, I don't want to oversell it, I don't want to undersell a team like Albany or whatever, but it's probably fair to say you got the premier upstate matchup this Wednesday in the Dome as, Cornell and Syracuse square off. Real quick, thoughts on that?
Oh, what a huge game, and I just feel like I want to see this Pinnell-McGill matchup pretty badly, just to see, you know.
I've given you so much crap about it over the course of the last, like, years we've talked about it, and every time you get worked up because Brian didn't play.
Yeah, we talk about the game in which
Rob had 6 2 years ago.
Yeah, Pinnell kind of blew up in the Carrier Dome, and I was skeptic about whether or not that was really a showing of Pinnell versus what I thought was a very solid Syracuse defense back then. And I'll stick to my guns and say that we really didn't get to see the real deal matchup of John Lade versus Pinnell.
The way that people
are kind of deserving of seeing. But this year, you know, it's McGill versus Pinnell. And almost in the same way, you know what I can almost say about this is I will look at it the way that Durkin probably is now viewed for having defended Lyle effectively in that game. I don't think it's so much the task of McGill to try and shut Pinnell down by himself. I think it's, you know, it's a unit effort to try and limit what these guys do as an offense. Looking at what happened this past weekend, neither team had an easy game. Cornell actually had to battle back against a team that I'm blown away with actually how well they've come together in the face of some challenges.
That being Harvard.
I mean, they were really an impressive crew of people led by Devin Dwyer, who makes me proud that a skinny, you know, fairly small athletic kid like that can step up in Division I, because that would be my one thing about him, having watched him through his last couple years of his career, is that I thought he was going to have to pack some weight on to be an effective quarterback at the Division I level, and he's proven very quickly that he doesn't need that. You know, he's playing very, very well at a very high level. But anyways, Cornell had to come back, and I think that that's what's going to be interesting here, is that both teams are kind of coming off of hard-fought wins. It's not like either one of them had a cakewalk. I think that the team that might have been expected to win more easily would have been Cornell over Harvard, so I'm wondering, does that have an impact on them a little bit? Both of them were character wins because both teams had to come back. I'm just wondering how much the face-offs are going to come into play. One thing we didn't really touch on in the Syracuse-Princeton game was that Brendan Conroy comes off the bench and wins something like 13 of 18, which I think is one of the better individual performances Syracuse has had since Danny Brennan.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, how big of an impact is that going to be? The fact that Cornell's not going to be able to focus solely on one or two guys, it's kind of a big collection of players that are not on the level necessarily of a Pinnell and a Mock, the way that they play and finish together and connect together. But certainly very, very good players, as we saw last weekend. I mean, I thought Marasco kind of made his argument to be included in our Player of the Year watch. I don't think that anybody can really knock that kid at this point for the way he's playing. I mean, he's leading arguably one of the top teams in the country in a year when it was expected to be down. You know, he's got to have a big game. I mean, I'm sure that he's probably heard so much about Pinnell in his career, and him being 22 and kind of getting, you know, criticized, you know, like a lot of the 22s have. I just feel like this has Upstate battle written all over it, a lot of pride on the line. I think both teams are ultimately going to be NCAA tournament teams. I think that's obvious for Cornell, maybe becoming a little bit more obvious for Syracuse. Really interested in the defensive matchup here. I think Lemelinara is on the rise. He's a guy that's he stopped something like 58% of his shots and has been really quiet in the background. He made 14 saves against Princeton. Another thing that we could have talked about is being pretty big in that game, one goal game.
And Matt O'Connor played well too, I thought. I don't know how many saves he finished with, but I remember him making a couple of big saves in the second half. So, yeah, I mean, lighting up 13 goals, nine saves, it's not a great day, but I thought that he did play well.
No, he did. I mean, the thing, when you've talked about this before, the type of shots that Syracuse is able to generate speaks, I think, to just how different this offense is, because, you know, I have a lot of friends that are Syracuse fans. I've listened to them and their expression of what they think is going on in the field. And, you know, the way that Syracuse ran its offense the last few years got to a point where I think some people were a little bit frustrated to see it. You know, these long-winded isolations from up top that sort of never produced any, like, looks beyond that person going to the cage and fading into wheeling the ball around and trying it over again. It's so different this year. I mean, like, it just feels like I talked about interchangeable, too. I mean, sometimes I'm not even sure if guys are actually playing midfield and attack. It's just one big offense of six guys moving very, very well. So I'm pretty excited to see what happens here. You know, wondering how much the two-day turnaround, you know, because I think you have to have one practice off after that game, wondering how much the lack of time to prepare, you know, is going to have an impact on this game. Two really well-coached teams. I just wish I could be there. It's pretty exciting.
Well, at least we're going to be able to watch it on TV, and it'll also coincide with an Inside Lacrosse ESPNU chat. Make sure to check that out on InsideLacrosse.com. Casey, as always, good talking with you, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Bob.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex podcast continues with Brian Foley, who is checking back with us for the second time this weekend, as he is coming off of a doubleheader weekend, taking in Harvard versus Cornell on Saturday, Notre Dame versus Providence on Sunday. And Brian, let's start with that Ivy League matchup because, you know, obviously Cornell, a top-ranked team, getting a scare put into them a little bit, and certainly, you know, after struggling through the first three quarters, was able to explode offensively in the fourth quarter. And as you look at this result, you know, kind of the second time in 2 weeks that you know, similar unfolding of misfortune for Harvard late in the game after you know, dropping a disappointing result to Duke last weekend. What was your sense of how this game unfolded?
It just unfolded. I thought Cornell was flat through the first three quarters. In the fourth quarter, they just decided to turn it on and absolutely just blitzed the Harvard defense. Harvard's defense had no answer for them at all. Harvard, Cornell was moving the ball around much faster in the fourth quarter and getting guys wide open shots. And Harry Krieger from Harvard had no chance. I mean, guys are shooting balls from about 12 yards out, and he's just getting absolutely blitzed by shots going 90 to 100 miles an hour. It was just, Harry just had no chance on some of these shots that Cornell was taking in the fourth quarter. You know, Steve Mock kind of took over and, you know, helped out with Pennell, and it just, they really had no chance. Harvard had no answer for them in the fourth quarter. I think they lost like three or four straight face-offs in the fourth and ended up getting Cornell a little run going, and that's how he ran away with a two-goal victory. So, you know, Harvard's got some young players, so, you know, I think it's a learning experience for them. But you could tell Chris Wojcik, the Harvard coach, was very disappointed that it's the second straight week they picked up a loss to a top 10 team.
It's kind of interesting because at this point in the season, I think that, you know, teams with, you know, good records, top of the charts, certainly have title aspirations, are just kind of looking to get through things. You know, they know that their conference tournament and maybe, you know, some rivalry games are kind of on the horizon. So, you know, folks that got an opportunity to see Maryland play against Navy on Friday night saw a similar type thing. You know, the Terps just came out a little bit flat, didn't put in their best showing of the year. And for both of these squads, it's kind of been, you know, a little bit par for the course. You know, it's not as if they haven't had some good performances over the last 2 weeks, and certainly it's not as if they won't have a couple good performances over the next week or so. And obviously Cornell with a midweek matchup against Syracuse has a nice opportunity to do that, to come alive a little bit. But, you know, did you talk to anybody involved in Cornell staff or on the team afterwards and get a little bit of a sense of, you know, maybe it's just, we know we're good, we need to get through this stretch and move on?
I talked to Coach Luca at the end of the game, and he said he challenged the team at halftime. They didn't respond in the third quarter at all. Actually, Harvard, I think, outscored Cornell in third, and then in the fourth, he challenged him again during one of the during the switch over the quarters, and the team finally responded with the leadership skills of Steve Mock and Rob Pennell, that they really got, you know, the leaders started stepping up for Cornell and showed in the fourth quarter when they outscored Harvard 7-2. So he said the team just finally responded in that fourth quarter because they were not responding to him through the first half at all and also in the third quarter. So you could tell he thought the team was a little, like, flat throughout the game. And really, I think, honestly, the team was overlooking Harvard this weekend for that Syracuse game on Wednesday. You know, because last week they had an easy game against Harvard that they won, what, 21-5 or something like that. So I think they just overlooked Harvard a little bit and almost caught him. But, you know, good teams always come through in the end.
You mentioned that Chris Wojcik was disappointed, you know, to have this type of result for the second week in a row. And when you look back over Harvard's season so far, they're 4-6. You know, they had a 2-goal loss to UMass at the beginning of the season. Obviously, that's changed a little bit, in terms of its quality, its value over the course of time. Went over Georgetown, who just upset St. John's. That looks a little bit better. You know, played Brown to 2 goals. At this point in the season, you know, it's unfortunately probably gotten a little bit too far away from Harvard, but you've gotten an opportunity to see him play a couple times. They've got, you know, they end their season with three top-quality opponents in Penn, Princeton, and Yale. So basically, they're in a perfect position to be able to play the spoiler role. For fans that haven't seen Harvard so far this year, how much do you believe in this team as being able to knock off one of those Ivy League tournament contenders down the stretch? And what are some of the other things that you see are important about Harvard going forward? Not just this season,
yeah,
but moving on to the next couple years for, like you said, this young team.
Yeah, the biggest issue with I wouldn't want to play Harvard at all the rest of the year because they're a dangerous, dangerous team. Devin Dwyer has stepped into a leadership role. He's basically quarterback in the offense. From the beginning of the year when I saw him against UMass, he wasn't demanding the ball. He wasn't getting involved at all in the offense. Since that UMass game that I covered, and now last 2 weeks I've covered Harvard, he stepped into more of a leadership role on the offensive end as a freshman, and he's setting up guys for wide-open shots. It's just a lot more flow since he's trying to take more of a leadership role on offense. And get, what's the defense name? Jovac or something like that?
Duvnik?
Yeah, that kid. There you go. He's been absolutely a beast, like getting ground balls and stuff like that. So both of those two freshmen are really starting to show up into the game. So Dwyer, I think, has a possibility in 2 or 3 years being a candidate for the Torrington Award and stepping up because he's that good of a player. He can dominate games at times. I thought they did a really good job with Sub Pennell on Saturday, but, you know, you can't stop everybody with Cornell. So I thought Harvard's defense did a good job on Pennell, but, you know, Steve Mock absolutely destroyed him. I think Mock scored 6 goals. So you got to pick and choose your battles when you play Cornell.
And then moving on to Sunday, you know, obviously a Providence team that got off to a good start, got a lot of attention, certainly after, you know, making some strides in the offseason. Certainly, you know, coaching change with Kis Gabrielli being a key component to that. And Notre Dame coming off of an upset loss to St. John's last weekend. Interesting battle, you know, one of those Big East games that could be, you know, I suppose a little bit more interesting than some other, you know, some impartial observers might expect. And you mentioned before we started recording that this game was closer than the score indicated. What makes you say that? I think the final was 13-8.
13-8 game. I think it was like a 7-7 game midway through the quarter, and basically Notre Dame just ran them off the field for the last like quarter and a half, and scored. They basically just blew it open late in the game, Notre Dame, to make it really a lot worse than it actually indicated. So it's just Notre Dame was. I thought Notre Dame was even flatter than Cornell. Florence plays on a very difficult field to actually just walk in on. The field's not really the greatest facility in the world. So I think Notre Dame wasn't prepared for the type of battle they're going to get from Providence. And they got a battle through at least a half of the game. I think Notre Dame had a one-goal lead at halftime. Florence actually tied up in the third quarter there for a while. So it's just, you know, the biggest issue for Providence, from a Providence perspective, was Providence couldn't win the faceoff. They won 4-for-21 in the game, so that's the reason why Notre Dame was able to dominate its possession late in the game. But if you look at it all day, Notre Dame hit, I think Jack Connolly had 13 saves through like three quarters. He was just absolute beast in the cage early in the game. And Notre Dame was taking bad shots. I mean, absolutely bad angles. Connor Doyle was taking shots from goal line extended, you know, basically goal line extended. Matt Cavanaugh did nothing for Notre Dame yesterday. I think he scored one goal. He was not involved in the offense at all. So it was just, I thought it was a very poor performance by Notre Dame this weekend. You know, they might have won 8-13-8, but I thought Providence had a chance to win that game. That's what I'm telling you. And I didn't think Notre Dame played even remotely close as good as they could. You know, Providence isn't the best program in the Big East, and you know, you would think Notre Dame would have been able to take a much more control of the game than they weren't able to do that. They made a lot of sloppy passes in the first half. I think they had, like, 10 or 11 turnovers in the first half and just absolutely just didn't get their game done.
It's an interesting result, particularly, you know, when you look at one of the reasons that Notre Dame might have struggled, the absence of Liam O'Connor, their faceoff guy who was injured against St. John's. I believe it was in the second quarter of that game. You know, you would think that maybe that had something to do with the outcome, but it wasn't a problem at the faceoff X, you know, for Notre Dame. They managed to do a good enough job. Nick Acello, I think, was dominant at times. He won 17 faceoffs. So, you know, it is interesting, but I wonder, you know, Notre Dame kind of in that same mold as Cornell and Maryland in terms of just kind of needing to turn the corner a little bit. It's survive and advance type mentality through April, you know, in a way that's obviously different from the tournament, but, you know, just kind of continue to move forward and continue to win games. But Providence, a sneaky 7-5, and certainly, you know, the effort that they put in against Notre Dame, hopefully something they can build off. But Brian Foley, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast. We want to thank you again for joining us, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again before the year's out.
No problem, man.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.